Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm having a continuous conversation today, a continuing conversation today with Steve Greenfield. Yesterday he talked about 1968 and today with civil unrest, and we're going to discuss it further. So, Steve, how are you this morning?
Okay, how are you?
Good. You know, the one thing I noticed when I put the TV on is not everybody is wearing masks. A lot of people are not protecting themselves. So I'm thinking that instead of diminishing, this pandemic might further spread throughout the United States. What's your thought on that?
I think we're definitely at a very elevated risk right now of seeing a big resurgence in infection rates. I think there are a lot of reasons why we're at risk for that. And I think that our government institutions, even the ones that are headed by Democrats, are lulling us into a sense of security about the disease, even though many of them are frequently saying that they don't want that to happen to us. You know, there's a big, when you start all of your descriptions about how you're going to reopen public spaces and parts of the economy with a bunch of statistics about falling infection rates and you know, all these other things that they're telling us as the calculus of how they came about their, you know, came to these decisions about reopening, those statistics that they're giving as background to their decision-making process cannot help but make us feel complacent, to create the impression that the communicability of the disease itself has gone down, that the, you know, when they say, like, for example, if Andrew Cuomo were to say that we're on an arc down to where we started, right? Mm-hmm. What that means literally is that we're on our way on an arc down to where we were when the whole thing exploded.
Right.
I listen to people saying that, and I keep going, how could you keep telling people? Because it creates the impression, no matter how much you don't want it to, it creates the impression that the rate at which people are catching the disease is under control in some way. And it's not. Mm-hmm. It's under control because we're not open. And as soon as we become open with you know, a few million people now that are, you know, forget the rate at which new infections are starting, we've got millions of infected people walking around. At the beginning, we only had, like, you know, 10, you know, whoever came in through the airport. You know, in New York, we had, you know, 10 or 20 infected people that made this whole thing happen. And at the moment, even, you know, the rate of infection, the relative rate at which we're passing it to each other, isn't really the key statistic. The key statistic is how many of us are capable of communicating the disease. We got into all of this trouble with only, you know, 10 or 20 people that were capable of communicating the disease, and now we've got a couple of million that are capable of communicating it. So, you know, but on the positive side, and to stay where we were yesterday and continuing with what we were talking about yesterday, when I was down in Harlem on Saturday for several hours, mm-hmm. I was around, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, literally hundreds of thousands of people. And I think I saw two that weren't wearing masks the whole day. There is definitely a difference in people's attitudes, outlooks on what to do in terms of reducing their capacity to communicate disease to others. I think in, you know, urban areas versus rural, you know, and the attitudes about that, it seemed like I was seeing people who were treating the matter as a simple procedural thing, right? This is what the experts are telling us is the best practice. we have been watching the devastation from this. What's the big deal? You know, people, whether it was the protesters, whether it was just families pushing their kids around in strollers, the kids were wearing masks, the parents were wearing masks. So, you know, we did unfortunately experience at the onset of this pandemic, the immediate transition, as always seems to happen these days, the immediate transition of basic, you know, of basic factual information, best practices, and best knowledge into, you know, the usual culture war divide. You're like angry, gun-toting, you know, right-wing white people were told to see it one way. This is a liberal, and they're, you know, storming state capitals with guns because they want to get their nails done and they don't want to wear a mask. And, you know, people are dying, you know, 100,000 people dead. And then so now we, you know, they quickly set up the traditional dynamic of, you know, this is, you know, something that liberals are doing to restrict your freedom. And you know, we're at a really, really terrible place as a nation where we seem to have a divided media that spends the first 24 or 48 hours of any particular issue arising trying to figure out how to present it as two sides of a cultural divide instead of just presenting it as, you know, here, this is what happened. You know, I don't think the media today is even capable of reporting on a plane crash without, you know, somebody saying, you know, oh, the plane crashed because big government got in the way of private enterprise policing its own, say, you know, and the other. It was a plane crash, right? Just cover it as a plane crash. We just don't do that. We don't do that anymore. We're back into a pre-Civil War mentality right now where we don't even form our own thoughts about any particular topic until the spokespeople for what we perceive as our tribe get a good framework together to tell us how we should think about it. You know, nobody wants to go out on a limb as soon as something becomes a piece of news and say, here's what I think. We sit around and wait, well, what did Rachel Maddow tell us? Wait, what did Sean Hannity tell us? Okay, now we all know what we're supposed to share on social media, what we're supposed to think about the issue. You know, it's terrible. It's really terrible. But again, we're trying to stay where we were when we left off in yesterday's show, which was when
okay,
it got down to the...
Steve, before we get into that, I have one more question for you. All of this stuff happened at the beginning of last week. So it's almost a week that people are taken to the streets and stuff. Where's Joe Biden?
You know, but Joe Biden is just being Joe Biden. This is his brand. Being nowhere and saying nothing is what Joe Biden does. That was the whole basis of his campaign, right? We're just gonna go back to some, you know, to some earlier system. He kept using the word normalcy, you know, and. You know, what we're seeing right now, you know, this thing, for example, a person being executed in the streets by a police department, that happens during normalcy. You know, Freddie Gray, that was during the Obama administration. And this is normalcy, like his brand as a candidate. Let's also remember that Joe Biden made a couple of earlier efforts going all the way back to the 1980s. To try to turn the corner and become a national candidate, and it collapsed both times, like very early on. This is a person who never was a national figure, was never had, like he's a complete nothing. He's the absence of leadership. That's his brand, is the absence of leadership. Someone who's just in the mix in Democratic Party politics. You know, being part of the establishment agenda and the means by which it's accomplished. And so now, you know, why anybody would be wondering, where's Joe Biden? Where's Joe Biden is where Joe Biden has always been and where he promised us he would be taking us if we made him the candidate, right? Like, so Joe Biden's, he's got nothing to say. He's not even willing to say right now that he's removing Amy Klobuchar from consideration to be his vice presidential nominee, even though there's a lot of news circulating and a lot of anger circulating about the fact that when she was a prosecutor in Minnesota, that she received complaints about this particular police officer. And whether the facts, whether she's going to argue that the facts of a specific case did not argue in favor of a prosecution, and that could even actually be factually true about that specific case. The fact of the matter is that she did sit atop the prosecutorial system that covers for bad policing. That's what it does. It has to cover for bad policing, because if it doesn't, the police stop cooperating with prosecutions and investigations, right? We know how this system works and why cops are always let go. And she sat atop, and clearly there are many other people that he can name to be his vice presidential nominee. Why he, you know, there's no cost to him to say, "I'm no longer considering Amy Klobuchar." There's no cost if he doesn't want to say it himself, to tell Amy Klobuchar to get on TV and say, "I'm withdrawing my name from consideration. I no longer think this is a good time for me to position myself as promoting my own interest in one day becoming president of the United States. This is, you know, I'm going to de-escalate, cool things down, and say I'm taking my name out of consideration." No, she's not doing that. He's not doing that. You know, there's nothing to say. And that's why they're not saying it. You know, these are people who sit atop the very same white supremacist institutions. You know, we have to stop pretending that there is a clear partisan choice in how this is approached, because Joe Biden wrote the crime bill, right? Amy Klobuchar was a prosecutor sitting atop that system. You know, anybody who claims that mandatory minimum sentencing is really the issue. Well, what do you think Amy Klobuchar was doing? She was the prosecutor. What do you think Kamala Harris was doing? She was the prosecutor. These are the people that were there. Look at the other elements of this, the identity element, right? Both of them are women. One of them is a black woman. They both sat atop and enforced those prosecutions that demanded mandatory minimums, and they're Democrats. And right now they're both under consideration by the author of the crime bill. Of all people, the author of the crime bill is the nominee, and two of the people he's considering to be vice president, and obviously in so doing, considering them to be future presidents, because that's what this nomination means because of his age and the prominence of the position. He's nominating two people who were personally involved for their entire careers until they got to the Senate in prosecuting in favor of mandatory minimums, and that's the best the Democrats have to offer. You know, so you know, there's never an electoral solution to this until we start naming the problem, you know, for what it really is, for what it genuinely is. You know, so actually that's a good transition back to where we were when we ran out of time yesterday. We were at the exact moment in my description of the rally in Harlem where most of the people who had arrived on time for the beginning of the rally actually left in anger and marched and started taking over streets because somebody was speaking about the, you know, that everyone should vote, about the importance of voting, and that, you know, caused a very negative reaction from the crowd. A lot of booing, a lot of demand that they, you know, give up the mic and stop it. That was actually the moment when people decided to leave the rally. The speaker just before that woman said that had been advocating for being cooperative and following instructions from the police about where to stand and where to walk. And so, you know, the crowd was lost immediately by the first speaker who was, you know, instructing everyone to be cooperative with the police about where they stand on the sidewalk, something that mundane. And then when he gave up the mic while everyone was booing, the next speaker came on and she got right down to talking about voting, which is a bizarre thing to be talking about in a city that is, you know, 90% Democrat, that the city council, every borough president, the mayor, you know, the public advocate, every prominent position in the city, all the judges, they're all Democrats. We live in a state. We live in a state that's run by Democrats, both houses of the legislature, the governor, all Democrats. And we're so blue, 1.5 to 2 million votes blue in presidential elections, that even if, you know, 300,000 new black people registered to vote for Joe Biden, he'd still get the same 100% of electoral votes as he would if they all stayed home. It doesn't matter. Everyone knows that, right? The crises that we're experiencing them in blue states as well as red, this traditional black Democratic establishment message of let's get out there and register people to vote. Let's get out there and vote. Again, sometimes that's a generally good thing to think about, right? I vote. I run for office. I'm not going to stand here and say, you know, no, don't vote. I'm just saying that the crowd immediately recoiled. This is not like me as a radical and a rare outlier who is observing, you know, why would you talk about voting at this exact moment, you know, in this exact setting? The whole crowd, you know, was hostile to it and walked off. That was the moment they left, just, you know, left the rally and walked off and seized control of a major street, a six-lane boulevard in Harlem, and ultimately the FDR Drive, the East Side Drive, the six-lane, you know, high-speed highway at the perimeter of Manhattan Island, and shut that down for quite some time before then I walked back to the original site of the rally to see what had developed at that point. And so this is, you know, a really important thing to think about, which is why do we constantly respond to these incidents by giving people the same messages that we've given them every single time that one of these incidents happened that has not once produced the desired result? You know, at what point do we say, this time I'm going to come up with something different, or this time I'm going to allow the people to lead. I'm going to allow the people that are affected to lead. I'm going to get out of the way. I obviously don't have any new ideas on this topic, and I'm going to just observe for a little while. I'm going to observe what people are saying and doing as their natural response to this situation. I'm not going to get up and lecture them, don't do this, don't do that, do this instead, because obviously doing that over and over and over for 400 years already has not done anything, you know, to reduce the problem. And the problem is not simply that police beat people and shoot people and strangle people, right? That's just the part that gets caught on the cell phones and gets publicized, you know, going all the way back in my memory to, you know, Rodney King, which in the pre-cell phone era was caught on video and caused riots, you know, in its day, and of course produced the same result, right? None of the cops got punished, you know, the same as always, right? And then everything was just continued as it was. And so what I saw on Saturday was public recognition of the failure of traditional leadership, and not just traditional leadership in general, but the traditional leadership on these issues. On these issues that the people are now saying, you've got to be kidding me. This is what you came here to tell us. You know, we came out here today and this is your message. And they walked away. These people that were speaking at the microphone, these were black people. You know, this wasn't, you know, white leadership of white liberal leadership. This was, you know, people who organized this rally. I didn't have time to learn about all their individual backgrounds, but they got a permit, they had a rally, they had a sound system, you know, some kind of established organized advocacy groups and leadership, and they were abandoned. People got disgusted and walked away right from the outset, and then did their own thing. You know, so I went with the breakaway group, right? I wanted, it's important to me to observe what's happening, you know, with ordinary people who are making up their own minds and taking their own actions rather than waiting, as we discussed a few minutes ago, for somebody in charge of something or in leadership of something to frame for them what they should be thinking and what they should be doing. That's just, you know, who I've always been and, you know, that missing piece of information, right, that's not getting onto CNN, which is what are the people themselves thinking and doing. And that sense that the leadership is breaking down, that people are no longer following orders. This is a thing we really need to wrap our heads around, because it's not because only because of, you know, structural racism and police brutality. That's just something that's happening this week. A few weeks back, when those giant four-hour lines started forming to food distribution centers, was the first time that I started saying to people, this is what the early stages of rebellion look like. This is what it looks like. People don't have work. People are actually sitting in traffic for 3 hours to get dinner so they don't starve. You know, 40 million people are unemployed, and we have rampaging illnesses, and not just COVID-19, right? People, we've discussed this, people who are below the poverty line, their life expectancy is 20 years lower than the rest of us. Internationally, our maternal mortality rates and our infant mortality rates are in the mid to upper 50s in the world. These are the things that we just incorporated as part of our ordinary lives until COVID-19 came along and demonstrated to us just how close to the edge of the cliff all of our efficiency systems of economic and civil administration have left us with no resilience and no way to survive, partial changes in circumstances in this way. And then you throw in, you know, Joe Biden versus Donald Trump, and nobody presenting, an economic plan, a health plan, a peace plan, an environmental protection plan, a housing plan, a plan for anything, and that we're being forced to choose between two different purveyors of a brutal, violent, white supremacist mass incarceration system. And with people having spent the last 90 days basically sitting at home with nothing to do but think about stuff, that's another thing we forgot about, right? Most of the time we're distracted. Life is hard. We get up in the morning, we eat breakfast, we take a shower, we go to work, we come home 9 hours later. We want to have dinner. We want to sit with our family. We want to watch television, right? Most people are not like me. Most people don't sit around thinking all day. They don't have the time. And that's perfectly, that's life on life's terms, right? Everybody's working. Everybody has earned a couple hours a day of rest and recreation. Everyone has earned the right to go to the movies, to go to a bar, go see a band, go take a vacation at the beach somewhere, right? That's life on life's terms. We can't demand that everybody be in a pre-revolutionary state, you know, all the time, because they're just trying to survive. And even people that are doing better than surviving, even people that are, you know, ambitious in their careers, well, they have to do that too. They have to do whatever it takes to keep, you know, growing and bettering their own situation, you know. So that's the real world. And what's happening right now is that on top of everything else, everybody's sitting at home now doing nothing but observing what's happening around them, and in most cases having the time available to think and react. That's never happened. And so with all the various things that are going on, we were clearly in the perfect storm, you know, the conditions upon which people become indignant and then angry and then moved to react in some way. Even those, you know, militant white people with their AR-15s that are storming state capitals, you know, they've been more visibly in a pre-revolutionary state for quite some time now, right? We saw them turn out at the Bundy Ranch on the overpass with their guns. They came from all over the country, you know, to take positions up there to fight the Treasury agents that were coming to that land to extract payment from the Bundy family for their back taxes. We have a tendency not to acknowledge when minorities are in a pre-revolutionary state because we've been trained ever since the 1960s to not recognize black anger. We only recognize, you know, people that we perceive as playing by the rules, as being nonviolent, you know, as if that is even, as if back then, even that was the only way that people were reacting, which is obviously not true, because we all remember the Black Panthers, and we all remember, you know, Stokely Carmichael and his breakaway group, and we remember Malcolm X, and there were plenty of black organizations, not just random people in the street, that were not operating under the nonviolence paradigms that came to be viewed by white liberals as a moral inflammation that would lead to progress. So there's, of course, also been many, many black people in a pre-revolutionary state for quite some time now, but white liberals look away from that. We don't want to, it's easier to look at white, angry white people who are potentially violent, because those are the bad people, right? The angry white people with guns and violence, those are the bad people. Those are the Trump people. Those are the Republicans. Those are the Fox viewers. We can look down on them, you know, and say that's wrong. But then there's a problem, because if you allow yourself to see the presence of angry black people, well, those are the people you're hoping are going to vote for Democrats, right, and stop the Republicans. So there's too much at stake to put on television the way that we see these white people with their guns on television. We can't put angry pre-revolutionary black people on television, because that breaks down the stereotype that white liberals need about good versus evil and, you know, nonviolence versus violence. And as a result of that, they are also not seeing the anger. They're erasing a significant part of the oppressed population because it doesn't fit with what they need politically, you know, in drawing that culture war divide and that partisan Democrat versus Republican divide. And so we're also seeing right now, because of the violence that we're seeing, there's this powerful resistance happening amongst white liberals that's sucking up all the space in the media and on social media, which is that everyone is saying, no, 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 all the violence is because of some white people that seem to be driving around the country to all these cities and infiltrating the protests and instigating the violence. And some of them are your young, you know, anarchist, left-wing, Antifa types. And some are these underground white supremacist white people that are trying to start a race war. And that's what they're talking about, instead of talking about the anger that's happening with black people, and not all black people, okay, just some, right? And here's where you get to the same problem, which is that no group is monolithic. And we have another big problem right now amongst white liberal thinking, that black people can be viewed as monolithic in terms of their strategies and tactics for advocating for their own liberation, and they're not. And so,
our time's up.
Our time's up again. My God, how are we going to do this? Well, you know, okay, it's up. And we can actually stop here, because maybe that's a bit of an advisory, a warning to people, right? Look at the big picture. Look at the big picture. It's not about white people doing things to infiltrate and mess up what would otherwise be a peaceful system. The system is violent towards black people. They know it. They've always known it. And some of them are reacting outside the model that liberal white people are comfortable with. And we have to acknowledge the reasons why that's happening and the role that white liberalism plays in generating that.
So you're running for Congress.
I'm running for Congress in New York's 19th District, the Mid and Upper Hudson Valley. Steve Greenfield for Congress .com. Send me an email at greenfieldforcongress at gmail.com. And as always, I heartily and enthusiastically challenge my opponent, and Democrat Antonio Delgado of the Wall Street wing of the Democrats, to a series of topic debates on the critical issues of the day. And I hope that he comes on your podcast as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Steve. Have a wonderful day. And thank you, everybody, for listening.